It is Monday, September 9th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellum. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. The KUAF website giveaway is offering season tickets to the Fort Smith Symphony's 90th anniversary season. One winner will receive a pair of tickets to Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, Wagner's Ring, the Canadian Brass, and more. The drawing will be held Friday, September 27th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information available at KUAF.com. Ahead on this Monday edition of Ozarks, the inspiration for the novel The Red Kimono. Jan Morrell explains how her family's history was a starting point for her book about American citizens taken to internment camps during World War II. Plus, the campus at Arkansas Tech University Ozark prepares for a milestone, and in about 6 minutes, why changes to the Arkansas River are part of a plan to help the entire region grow. But first, today, a three-day blood drive kicked off on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville. The All Islam Student Association is sponsoring its annual September 11 Memorial Blood Drive as part of the National Muslims for Life campaign. Sophia Nassim, the president of the registered student organization, says this is the third year the group has sponsored the event.
We just want to show the community and the rest of the world, basically, that Muslims are good community members. And they like to give back to their community. Like, the news and the media portrays Muslims in a certain way, and sometimes people's judgments can be affected by that. And we want to affect them in the opposite way and show them that we actually do good also.
This year's blood drive will honor victims of both the September 11, 2001 attacks and of this year's Boston Marathon bombing. Community Blood Center of the Ozarks is a partner for the event and is providing two blood mobiles and trained personnel. Hours for the blood drive, which runs through Wednesday, are 10 until 4 at the Fulbright Peace Fountain on the U of A campus. Organizers hope to collect at least 300 units of blood during the drive. September is National Recovery Month, and the Arkansas Department of Human Services is working to raise awareness about mental recovery and wellness in the state. According to the department, nearly 20% of young adults between the ages of 18 and 26 admit they are addicted to alcohol, while 32% of adults say they have poor mental health. Kate Luck, a spokeswoman with the Department of Human Services, says those statistics can change.
We want to get those numbers down, and we also want to get out the message that recovery is possible for every person. You know, some people think, well, I can't do it, and you can't do it on your own, but we have the programs in place, and whether you're struggling with some mental health issues or you're struggling with addiction issues, we've got programs in place to help you.
The full state profile on mental health can be found at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. September is also National Infant Mortality Awareness Month, and Governor Mike Beebe is calling attention to the issue. In his weekly radio address, he says while Arkansas's infant mortality rate has declined by more than 20% during the past 20 years, more work must be done to decrease the amount of infant deaths in the state. But Governor Beebe says several interrelated issues that are deep-seated in the South have to be addressed for change to occur.
On average, income levels are lower among Southerners than the rest of Americans, leading to a higher poverty rate in our region. Many of our citizens do not have jobs with health care benefits or cannot afford to self-insure. Annually, nearly one-third of expectant women experience a pregnancy-related complication. Expectant mothers who don't receive adequate prenatal care run the risk that such complications will go undetected or won't be identified soon enough. That, in turn, can lead to potentially serious consequences for both mothers and their babies.
This month, Governor Beebe takes over chairmanship of the Southern Governors Association, an organization he says has focused for decades on addressing the high rate of infant mortality in the region. Governor Beebe also says the Arkansas Health Insurance Marketplace, which will extend health insurance to thousands of Arkansas families, will include better prenatal and post-delivery care. Last week, President Obama declared six Arkansas counties disaster zones in the aftermath of several storms and flooding in early August. Over the weekend, a similar disaster declaration was issued for several Missouri counties affected by the same string of storms. McDonald and Berry counties in southern Missouri are included in the disaster declaration, meaning the area is eligible for 75% matching aid in cleanup and repair costs from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. A Fayetteville-based electronics firm has received a $2 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to develop better fuel efficiency in hybrid electric vehicles. Arkansas Power Electronics International, a firm based at the Arkansas Research and Technology Park, will lead a team that includes Toyota Motor Company's North American Division, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and GAN Systems. The collaboration will work toward developing new electric motor traction drives for hybrid vehicles using silicon carbide and gallium nitride semiconductors. Both of those emerging materials are known for their lighter weight and high energy efficiency, which in turn could lead to higher fuel efficiencies. The grant was one of 38 awarded across the country as part of a $45 million fuel efficiency effort by the Energy Department. The Razorback volleyball team traveled to Lawrence, Kansas this weekend to complete a home-and-home series against the Kansas Jayhawks. It took five sets, but the Razorbacks won Saturday night, with junior Meredith Hayes leading the team with 22 kills. Saturday's match was the first time since 2005 Arkansas faced the same opponent in consecutive matches. It was the first time ever the team had done so against a non-conference opponent. The Razorbacks will travel to Tulsa this weekend to participate in the Golden Hurricane Classic, which will feature Arkansas, Northern Colorado, and Tulsa, all of whom advanced to last season's NCAA tournament. The Razorback soccer team was also victorious this weekend. The team is now 6-0 after winning yesterday at Razorback Field over Nebraska 2-1. After four games in 10 days, the Razorbacks have most of this week off before a two-game road trip this weekend, which will begin Friday evening at Utah State. Clear tonight, lows from 65 in northwest Arkansas to the lower 70s in the Arkansas River Valley. Sunny tomorrow, highs will be in the mid-90s in northwest Arkansas, as warm as 97 for the Arkansas River Valley tomorrow afternoon. And for Tuesday night, mostly clear, lows from 63 to 72. This is Ozarks at Large. A coalition organized by the mayors of Fayetteville and Fort Smith is planning to build a regional intermodal hub to increase the transportation of manufactured goods and commodities. The group is starting from the bottom up in the navigation channel on the Arkansas River. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently traveled to the River Valley, and she has this report.
We're standing on the shoreline of the Arkansas River in downtown Fort Smith by Garrison Bridge. On occasion, you'll see gar sliding up and out of the water and back into its murky depths. And on even rarer occasions, you'll see barges, huge barges, move through. But they're kind of limited on this waterway. But now, a new coalition is forming to improve barge traffic on the river to boost the local economy.
A more productive river channel would be central to a new regional intermodal transportation hub at Fort Smith and Van Buren, extending into northwest Arkansas and beyond. Pushing the project are the mayors of Fort Smith and Fayetteville, who last year announced the formation of an alliance to develop mutual economic interests. Here's Fort Smith Mayor Sandy Sanders.
There is significant barge traffic up and down the Arkansas River. One of the things that we are working on is to get the Corps of Engineers to do some work to make the river certifiable to a 12-foot depth instead of the current 9-foot depth. The same barge, for basically the same cost, could carry about 40% more product.
The project is still early stage and will involve a lot of stakeholders. So far, the mayors have met with state and city officials, Arkansas legislators, and the Arkansas Land Commissioner, as well as members of the Arkansas delegation. Here's Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan.
I talked to Senator Pryor about it, and Senator Bozeman's aware of it, and Congressman Womack's aware of it, and they're working to get some money for that project. It's about a $180 million project. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but this will touch every city that is along that Arkansas River, right on up and to where we hook it up by railroad. And you can also move your trucks on the barges. And you can, and they can be let out at Fort Smith, Van Buren in that area, and they can make a short haul across. You can hook it up by rail, or you can have the trucks waiting when you bring the cargo ship in. For every large cargo ship that we move, barge that we move up that Arkansas River, is the equivalent of 80 large trucks. So you cut down on CO2 emissions.
CO2 emissions are 270% higher hauling freight overland by truck, according to one project study. Back in 2004, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which operates and improves transport waterways, was authorized to deepen the Arkansas River navigation channel to 12 feet under the Energy and Water Development Appropriations Act, estimated, as Mayor Jordan mentioned, to cost $185 million. Corps of Engineer navigation projects are paid for with a fuel tax collected from barge operators into a waterways trust fund, says Dennis Robinson, a senior economic researcher with UALR's Institute of Economic Advancement. And trust fund money would make up half the cost of this project. Problem is, the Corps' priorities are backlogged. But Dennis Robinson says this ambitious project could attract private funding.
In fact, there's been several examples where where that was done. One in particular in the state of Washington to deepen the channel approximately the same number of feet, 3 feet, on the Columbia River. It was of a magnitude in terms of monetary funding, about the same amount that would be necessary for the McCullen-Kerr Arkansas River system.
Institute of Economic Advancement Executive Director Jim Young says the dredging project needs to be taken into a much larger context.
That obviously is not only an asset when you start looking at the development of a new port at Van Buren, which when you tie in with the rail and the interstate highway system, that it's, you know, a multimodal hub and opportunity for job creation and expansion in Northwest Arkansas. You're not only benefiting Northwest Arkansas, but you're benefiting the whole state, and not only the whole state, but really the whole river corridor through parts of Oklahoma and all of Arkansas. So a lot of it has to do with the eventual opening of the Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal expansion project was initiated in 2006 and is scheduled for completion in 2015. It will double the capacity by allowing larger ships and more of them. On any given day, an estimated 100,000 oceanic barges plow through open seas, delivering as much as 90% of our global goods. It's not exactly a green industry, though, given the ships run on stuff called bunker fuel or thick, heavy fuel oil. But oceanic and inland waterway ships and barges move a lot more product compared to train and interstate. And the 445-mile-long McClellan-Kerr Arkansas River navigation system, established by an act of Congress in 1971, which extends from the Mississippi River northwest to Catoosa, Oklahoma, outside of Tulsa, carries barge traffic the equivalent to 58 million truck trips a year. UALR Economic Advancement Institute senior researcher Dennis Robinson says the Arkansas, the fourth longest river in the United States, is a historic transport waterway.
And it's approximately almost 1,500 miles long from there to where the river flows into the Mississippi River. About 445 miles are navigable and maintained for navigation from the Port of Catoosa downstream. About 309 or 10 miles of that 445 miles are in Arkansas. There are about 18 locks, 13 of which are in Arkansas. The river itself provides a number of different kinds of services other than transportation of commodities. It supplies water. I believe the water here we drink in Little Rock, it comes from the river. It supplies electricity through hydropower. It provides a cushion of safety because of flood control, and it, you know, it's a wonderful source of recreation. So, it's not just a river for transport, but it's a major function.
10.5 million tons of commodities worth more than $3 billion are hauled on the Arkansas River annually.
And that includes things like iron and steel, chemicals, petroleum, coke and coal, sand and gravel and rock, crops and forest products mainly. About somewhere average about 2 million tons each of those.
Fort Smith Mayor Sandy Sanders says when completed, the effects of the McClellan Kerr Arkansas River Navigation 12-foot channelization project will attract new industry and be far-reaching.
Well, there's a current port in Van Buren, Five Rivers, and then the port of Fort Smith as well. The Five Rivers operates the port of Fort Smith for us, and there's a potential intermodal facility being looked at, again, in conjunction and partnership with the Corps of Engineers to establish a new intermodal port. But I-49 would serve all of us.
And Interstate 49, under construction for the past 30 years, once completed, will also be part of the transportation hub connecting Canada to the Gulf Coast. The last legs to be built are in Arkansas, from Alma to Texarkana, including a new bridge across the Arkansas River, will create, when done, a transcontinental interstate crossroads with western Arkansas in the epicenter. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Arkansas banking industry is watching a bidding process early this week that developed as a bit of a surprise last week. That's one of the subjects covered in Roby Brock's weekly recap of the business and political news in Arkansas.
In surprise moves, Bentonville-based Arvest Bank and Pine Bluff-based Simmons First National Corporation submitted bids to acquire Little Rock-based Metropolitan National Bank, whose parent company Rogers Bankshares is embroiled in a bankruptcy proceeding. Arvest bid was announced in a legal notice in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette for an undisclosed figure, while Simmons First disclosed a $16.9 million bid in an SEC filing. Metropolitan officials announced in early July that the bank would be acquired by Ford Financial Fund II, a private equity fund led by Dallas investor Gerald J. Ford. Ford Financial Fund II said at the time it was aiming to purchase all of Metropolitan National Bank stock for $16 million and recapitalize the bank. Former President Bill Clinton used the forum of his presidential library to advocate for the Affordable Care Act, which hits a major milestone on October 1st when health insurance exchanges open a new online marketplace. Clinton spent his speech at the Clinton Center chronicling the positives and negatives of the current federal law. He also promoted Arkansas's private option plan and, in prepared remarks, recited the mechanics of how citizens can access the forthcoming options in Arkansas. State finance officials said that one-time sales tax audit payments and higher corporate income tax collections boosted August revenues. Sales tax collections also showed signs of life despite a sluggish year overall. The Department of Finance and Administration reported that August net available general revenues topped $387 million. That is up 5.1% above last year and 1.5% above forecast. Home BancShares, the parent company of Centennial Bank, said it's received approval from the Federal Reserve Board and the Arkansas State Bank Board to move forward on its merger with Jonesboro-based Liberty BancShares. In late June, Conway-based Home BancShares triggered a summer of banking headlines with its $280 million acquisition of Liberty. Arkansas has a new public company, the spinoff of the El Dorado-based oil and gas parent company Murphy Oil Corporation. Murphy USA opened for trading on Tuesday, September 3rd, on the New York Stock Exchange under the trading symbol MUSA. The stock began at $37.30 per share. The standalone company represents Murphy Oil's retail and refinery business segments. The Arkansas Economic Development Commission said Nordex USA will repay the state and city of Jonesboro more than $2.5 million in grants it received when it opened its North American wind turbine manufacturing facilities in Craighead County. Nordex announced in July that it would close the Jonesboro facility, which made parts for large industrial wind turbine units due to the uncertainty in the North American wind energy market. The company announced its location in Jonesboro in 2009. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas provides weekly recaps on most Mondays on Ozarks at Large. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks comes from Mitchell Williams Law, providing diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Mitchell Williams Law Firm employs nearly 80 attorneys in offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, Congress returns from its summer break. Will other lawmakers join Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who voted against military intervention in Syria?
How confident are you that we can, in fact, put in place a military plan that's limited in scope and duration that can effectively degrade Assad's capability to carry out future chemical attacks?
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now this afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM. The Eureka Springs Original Ozark Folk Festival presents a live recording of Michael Jonathan's Wood Songs Old Time Radio Hour, Saturday, October 26th, in the City Auditorium. Submissions are now being accepted for local talent to perform during this worldwide broadcast. Entries must be received by September 15th. Information is available online at ozarkfolkfestival.com. This week, many colleges and universities in the region will have official headcounts for fall enrollment numbers. As Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reports, one school in the Arkansas River Valley is expecting record numbers again, while also celebrating a decade under its current name.
In recent weeks, colleges have been releasing their official enrollment numbers for the fall semester. Thursday, Arkansas Tech University Ozark campus will do the same, and officials are anticipating an enrollment of more than 2,100. In the fall of 2004, ATU Ozark had an enrollment of 301. If the anticipated enrollment for the fall is correct, this would be the ninth consecutive year the college has set an enrollment record. ATU Ozark was established in 1965 as Arkansas Valley Vocational Technical School. In 1991, the campus was renamed Arkansas Valley Technical Institute, and on July 1, 2003, AVTI merged with Arkansas Tech University to become Arkansas Tech University Ozark Campus. That merger will be the focus of a celebration tomorrow at the Student Services Conference Center. Bruce Sykes is Chief Academic Officer and Acting Chancellor at ATU Ozark. He joined the university in 2007 and says the administrators have been very aggressive in growing programs, building onto campus, and building partnerships throughout the region.
Basically, what we recognized was that students, communities, industry was being underserved as far as two-year degree programs that led directly to jobs. You know, our campus is focused on its mission, and our mission is of course, you know, it's about a quality education, but it's really more than that. It's about, you know, what we offer our community and what we offer industry and what we offer students. And we are career education. And career education, in our definition, you know, is basically centered around why would you go to college to get trained? Well, ultimately, it's to get a job. All of our degrees are directly linked to specific jobs. They're very narrow in their focus. So a student would come here for 2 years, and they would be trained in specific skill sets where they could go out and be an occupational therapist assistant or a physical therapist assistant, an RN, a PN, a paramedic, you know, a person that does electronic medical records in the field, or an automotive service technician.
With the merger, Sykes says they maintained their identity as far as being committed to technical trade areas. He says the merger allowed them to begin offering associate degrees and expand their offerings. In 2004, the Arkansas Department of Higher Education approved 13 technical certificate programs for the school. In 2005, the ADHE approved 3 Associate of Applied Science programs. Today, ATU Ozark offers 11 associate degrees and 15 technical certificates, with 27 total program options. Sykes says during the last 5 or 6 years, they have really centered expansion on the allied health fields. Besides an increase in programs, Sykes has seen a number of other changes during his time at ATU Ozark.
Diversity of student population is one. I think the second probably would be our outreach. You know, I think when we first merged with Arkansas Tech, we probably were considered to be a very small regionally accepted institution. We get students now from across the state that are seeking out these type of programs, and it's a neat thing. We feel like you know, Interstate 40 is something that if you're going to drive down Interstate 40, you're going to go through Arkansas Tech country, whether it's through Arkansas Tech Ozark or the Arkansas Tech University system. And so I think those were a couple of things that we were definitely working on.
Part of that outreach has included the expansion of the campus to other teaching centers. In addition to overseeing the Arkansas Tech Career Center in Russellville, which enrolls more than 600 students from 11 high schools in Pope, Yell, and Johnson counties, ATU Ozark offers adult education in Franklin, Logan, and Johnson counties, and hosts classes at the Boonville Training Center, Morrilton Training Site, Morton Hall in Russellville, and Fort Chaffee Crossing. As ATU Ozark has continued to grow, people have started taking notice.
I think industry is starting to recognize that, hey, if you want to go into an allied health field, or if you want to be a welder, or if you want to be an automotive service technician, or electronic medical records, where are you going to go to school? Well, you need to go to Arkansas Tech University Ozark campus. We've got some programs that I feel like are just diamonds. Industrial control systems is a applied engineering program that's a two-year program on our campus. And, you know, if somebody wants to work in the field of robotics or electronics or working with the machines that actually cause manufacturing to do their thing, well, where are you going to go to school? Well, Arkansas Tech University Ozark is your choice, school of choice. The same thing with the allied health programs. Like I was saying, they are unique. Not only in the area, but they're unique in the state, and particularly if you look at the whole. I mean, we're offering 9 allied health programs right now, soon to add a 10th. We're committed to health care.
The campus itself has seen physical changes during the past decade. The Ozark campus has added a half-mile walking trail thanks to its first capital campaign and a disc golf course. ATU Ozark revamped the Student Union area, which now features food services, the bookstore, library, and computer lab. The campus has also seen the addition of a 12,500-square-foot student services and conference center, which will be the site of a ceremony tomorrow morning to mark the 10th anniversary of the merger. Bruce Sykes, Chief Academic Officer and Acting Chancellor, says the public event will offer a time to celebrate the institution's successes.
We're also going to be celebrating the fact that, you know, we're not done. We do have a new Allied Health building that is on the drawing board, and we'll be working to start maybe breaking ground within a year. So the 10th is a time to celebrate all those things. We're asking Dr. Brown, the president of Arkansas Tech University System, he will be the speaker, and we're asking him to reflect on the merger because he was instrumental in developing the merge. And who would have thought that at that time, little old Votech and Ozark would, with 300 students, would be looking at 2,100 students in the fall of 2013 because of a merger with Arkansas Tech University.
The Arkansas Tech University Ozark campus 10th anniversary celebration is scheduled for 11 tomorrow morning at the Student Services Conference Center. Lunch will be served following the ceremony, and you can RSVP by calling 479-508-3304. More information is available at atu.edu. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It is Monday, September 9th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hello.
And how are you?
I seem to be all right. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
Let's talk about road trips because there's not enough to do around here.
All right. Where are you going to take us?
We are going to go see a band called Imagine Dragons. Recommended by Kevin Kinder, the What's Up music writer. It is an alt-rock band that released the album Night Visions in 2012. Billboard magazine has named them the breakthrough band of 2013. And they've got hits such as Radioactive and It's Time. They're on tour with stops at the Verizon Wireless Amphitheater on the 14th near St. Louis, and the 27th and 28th at the Southside Ballroom in Dallas. And you can find out more at ImagineDragonMusic.com.
All right.
Also, if you're out and around on the 10th, which is tomorrow, Jars of Clay are at the Revolution Music Room in Little Rock.
Contemporary Christian band.
On the 14th, Michael Bublé, that's Saturday, at the Scott Trade Center in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. I heard squealing. And on the 20th.
Not from over here.
No, from over there. But there are lots of people, yes, I know who squeal over Michael Bublé. And on the 20th, Mumford & Sons, one of Kevin Kinder's favorite bands, is at the Cricket Wireless Amphitheater in Kansas City.
Just a 3.5-hour drive.
There you go.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Jan Morell's novel, The Red Kimono, was originally going to be a biography about her mother. Early in the process, though, Jan Morell decided to write a fictional story instead, though still inspired by two events in her mother's life: her mother's internment as a 7-year-old girl in a camp during World War II, and the murder of her mother's father by two teenagers shortly after the family's release from the internment camp. The Red Kimono follows the lives of the people connected to those fictionalized events and examines the roles of forgiveness, loyalty, and faith in one's life. The novel, published by the University of Arkansas Press, opens in 1941, specifically December 7th of that year. As in reality, soon after the attack on Pearl Harbor, many Japanese Americans are sent to internment camps in the Red Kimono, including camps in Arkansas. I recently talked to Jan Morell about the book, and I asked her about the real events she called upon for inspiration.
How old were you when your mother would talk about being an internee?
She really didn't talk about it very much at all, because the few times I remember her talking about it, she would start to cry. And as a child, probably I didn't want to see that, so I probably avoided the topic myself. But I do remember her when I was about 10 years old. We were on a family vacation, and we stopped at one of the old sites. It was Tule Lake. And as children, we thought a camp sounded fun, you know, and we were looking all around for things you would do at a camp. And it was, I still remember seeing my mother standing off by herself crying about it. And I think at 10, I was beginning to be a little bit more aware of what this was like for her as a child. And then she told me that even though I'm only half Japanese, that if I had been alive back then, I would have been in an internment camp also. And I think that is when I really realized what it would have felt like to be in a camp.
She was an internee at age 7.
Yes.
How much have you talked to her about how much she understood about she was being sent to this camp merely because of?
I think at that age, she didn't understand that so well. She knew that they had to leave their home quickly. She knew that they lost most of their belongings. I've never specifically asked her that, but I don't think at 7 that she probably understood why all of that was happening. Now, she was the youngest of 9 children, and I know that her older brothers knew what was going on. In fact, one of her brothers served in the 442nd, her oldest brother. And so that was one reason that I split my characters into a 9-year-old little girl and her 17-year-old brother, because they each saw what was going on differently. And when I talk to former internees now, I'm not surprised, but it makes me feel good that I got that part right, that as a child, it was almost fun because their parents protected them from what was really going on. And as Saatchi in my book felt, she was finally with people who looked like her. And so she saw it differently from how her brother, 17-year-old, saw it.
In The Red Kimono, which is a novel, which is fiction, you have these lives that are intertwined. It's shortly after, well, not shortly, but soon after Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And schoolmates that don't know how they're going to interact.
Mm-hmm.
A Japanese man is killed, murdered, mm-hmm. as revenge.
Mm-hmm.
For a child whose father was killed in Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Did you always know that would be what would start the process of the book?
Yes. Yeah, because I obviously did know how my grandfather's death affected my mother. I wanted to take that and not really make sense out of it, but The reason for the murder in the book is completely different from what happened in real life. But I still wondered, I remember wondering with the boys in real life what was going through their head, what would cause them to do something like that. And even as a child, I used to like to write and make up stories. And so I wanted to create this character and try to figure out what would cause somebody to kill a man like that. And, of course, I came up with a completely fictitious and I don't want to say more honorable reason, but he was hurting. And he was a good kid, but he got with the wrong people and decided this would make him feel better, which in the end it didn't.
So we have these three characters, well, more than three, but we have characters who find themselves incarcerated for different reasons.
Yes.
At different places.
Right.
And what really happens is we find out how that affects and how they all move on.
Right. They each meet different characters during their incarceration that in one way or another, whether positively or negatively, change their lives.
That's the spine of this story.
It is. It is. Because obviously, with this taking place during World War II and during the internment, that is the environment that they're in. But I feel like the themes in the book of prejudice and fear, forgiveness, are still relevant issues today. And really, my point in writing the book, not only to remind people of our history, but to try to tell in a story that sometimes we let our fear get a hold of us when all we need to do is try to get to know the person we're afraid of. It may work, it may not, but certainly if we don't try.
Was the process for you a very linear one? You knew you were going to start with this incident that linked the characters.
In general, it was linear, but I have a method of deepening my characters. I will often interview my primary characters in my head, and I have a list of questions that I ask them. And several times with this book, when I would ask these questions, new parts of the story would come out. And so in that way, it strayed a little bit from what I originally had intended. For instance, Juby. I didn't expect Juby to become a part of the story until I interviewed Saatchi. There's a scene in there where Saatchi makes a new friend in the camp, Sam, who is a boy, and her first crush. Well, that started out being a little girl. But when I talked to Saatchi about it, she said, no, it was a boy, and he was my first crush. And also the twist that came in the story was through interviewing.
I don't mean to pry into your process, but when you interview, how does that work?
It sounds a little bit crazy,
well,
doesn't
crazy.
It?
Well, not crazy. No, but I mean, how do you – this is going to be a crazy-sounding question. How do you make sure you're not manipulating the answers, which, of course, you are because you're the author?
Right. It's very hard to explain because it's strange that you could stare at a blank screen and wonder what to write, but you go into this different process – where I literally close my eyes. I have a blog entry I did called Happy Hour with Nobu. And I literally poured myself some hot sake, and I pretended I was sitting across a table from Nobu. And this was for the second book. I was really stuck on what Nobu's story was going to be in the sequel. And I started out asking him what has happened to you in the years since the internment, which this would have been about 8 years after internment. And he just started talking to me in my head. And of course, I'm imagining this as a movie. A major secret about Mama came out of that. And it doesn't feel like manipulation.
It sounds like meditation in a way.
It almost is. And I write as I'm imagining this so that I can get it all down on paper. And then I'll go back and pick and choose and fix it up later. But it's really amazing. And I actually talk to other writers about this process because it's a good way to get over your writer's block.
If you're an Arkansas native, you might know more about the internships than other people because there, of course, was the camp. But do you find that there are a lot of people that still really,
yes,
you're nodding, have no idea that this
yes
particular
yes
period of...
What I find is either people didn't know at all about it, and to be honest, I didn't know about the Arkansas internment camps because I'm not originally from Arkansas. And of course, all my mother ever spoke about were those on the West Coast. And so when I started writing this book, I won't say I was excited to hear about them, but it gave me a whole new dimension to the story that I was able to write. And even in Arkansas, though, there are many, many people I talk to that know little to nothing about the camps.
And imagine are quite surprised then when they hear
yes
that they existed.
Yes. But there is a new museum now down in McGee, Arkansas, and it opened in April, I believe. And it's a wonderful monument, not only the museum, but the actual site of Rohr Internment Camp. They now have kiosks where you can walk along a path and learn about various parts of the internment camp.
I'm curious, has your mother read the book?
Yes.
What'd she say?
You know, my mother is not a reader, and before the book was published, I let her read the manuscript. I put it on her iPad for her, and it would make me very happy whenever I would walk in and find her just glued to the iPad. But one of my favorite stories is she told me in a couple of parts where I needed to fine-tune the cultural aspect of it. But one of my favorite parts was there's a scene where Sachi is stacking rocks on top of a fence post, and it's something that her father taught her to stack rocks as a form of meditation if she was unhappy. And when my mother read that, she said, Janice, she couldn't have stacked rocks on those posts because she couldn't have reached it. And it's something I would have never thought about, but it told me that she was living that as she was reading it.
It had to make you a little, not anxious, but you had to be somewhat nervous handing over that manuscript on
yes.
the iPad.
Yes. I wasn't so nervous with my mother because she's my mother, but I have been and continue to be nervous about former internees reading it because it was very important to me to get the story accurately. And a lot of times in research, I found different stories, and some of them the facts, well, they were facts as these people remembered it, and they were a little bit different from what you might read that somebody else wrote about. And so my biggest fear was somebody reading it saying that didn't happen. And I guess that's why we do say it's historical fiction, even though I wanted everything to be accurate. So I still, if I read a review by a Japanese person, I kind of hold my breath till I get to the end.
You mentioned that one of the things you wanted to do was make sure you got details right. Is another aspect for the people who don't know that there were people interred, U.S. citizens, just the awareness?
Yes. I think it's very important to be aware that we did this once because in my mind, I don't think anybody would ever say we should ever intern our own citizens again, but we've already seen a slippery slope. And, you know, you go slowly down this slippery slope and you never know what might happen, and that's why I think it's important for us to remember.
Jan Morell's novel is titled The Red Kimono, and it's published by the University of Arkansas Press. She is now working on a sequel. You can learn more at janmorell.com. That's Jan, MORRILL.com.
Some organs can be transplanted, a heart, a lung, and some microbes inside an organ can be transplanted too. How about taking someone else's intestinal matter?
That is the most disgusting thing. And so, no way am I doing that.
But she did, and it cured her ailment. Microbiome transplants later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon at 3 on KUAF.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkan Songs. ...2007 marks the 50th anniversary of Stax Records, and there have been documentaries, box sets, concerts, and celebrations marking the event. And although the label made the most out of its Memphis hometown, Stax would have been but a shell of itself without several key Arkansasers, and some that weren't so key. One of the most important men at Stax Records wasn't even a musician. Al Bell was born Albertus Isbell in Brinkley and grew up in North Little Rock. He came to Stax as an A&R man, but got into record production, songwriting, and eventually was the head of Stax Records.
I met all of the musicians there, and Jim Stewart and Mrs. Axton developed a fondness and appreciation for them individually and loved the music.
Wayne Jackson of West Memphis played trumpet on nearly every important Stax release that had horns, from Sam and Dave to Otis Redding to, heard here, Eddie Floyd. Love, The Arkansas influence on Stax ranges from the rock band Black Oak Arkansas, who recorded an album for Stax when they were known as the Nobody Else, to Shirley Brown of Crittenden County, who had the last major hit for Stax. When the label was financially tanking in the mid-1970s, Stax began using the record pressing facilities of Wayne Rainey's record plant in Concord, Arkansas. Stax even bought the town a fire truck to protect its investment. One of the most successful performers on the Stax label was Johnny Taylor of Crawfordsville in Crittenden County. Nicknamed the Philosopher of Soul by the label, Taylor charted R&B hit after hit, culminating with the crossover smash, Who's Making Love? However, Taylor had the biggest hit of his career the year after he left Stax with 1976's Disco Lady. Johnny J.T. Taylor died in May 2000. Influencing everyone from Jimi Hendrix to Stevie Ray Vaughan, Albert King is one of the most imitated guitarists of post-war blues. And although the Stax label never gained much of a reputation for blues, King signed to Stax in 1966, and the next year, his signature hit, Born Under a Bad Sign, was released. King stayed with Stax until the original label folded in the mid-1970s, issuing such other enduring songs as I'll Play the Blues for You, Crosscut Saw, and As the Years Go Passing By. Albert King died in 1992 and is buried in Edmondson in Crittenden County.
Look out, your good thing is about to come to an end. No real good thing is about to come to an end.
Mabel John is the oldest sister of R&B legend Little Willie John, and both grew up in Ouachita County. She came to Stax after a stint on Motown Records and backing Ray Charles as one of the Raylettes. Mabel John scored a top 10 R&B hit and cracked the Pop 100 right out of the gate with Your Good Thing Is About to End, Her Here. But she never reached that chart success again and left Stax Records after 2 years. She eventually joined the ministry and got a doctorate, but never left music entirely. There are many other Arkansas ties of varying degrees at Stax Records. Harvey Scales of Osceola is best known as a songwriter for other artists, especially for his chart-topping Disco Lady of 1976, the hit for Johnny Taylor. Scales' other songs include Love Itis, and he's written songs for the Dramatics and the OJs. Heard here is Harvey Scales doing his own song, What's Good For You Doesn't Have to Be Good to You. Gene and the Darlings were a gospel-influenced quartet of two sisters, a daughter, and a family friend. Gene Dolphus and the Darlings sang backup on several Stax songs in addition to cutting their own 45s. Many Arkansasers helped craft the unique progressive sound of rock, blues, and especially rhythm and blues in the 1960s and 1970s, of which Stax Records of Memphis, celebrating its 50th anniversary in 2007, played a major part. Here in its entirety is Gene and the Darlings with It's Unbelievable How You Control My Love, released on Stax Records in September 1968.
I'm
Gene and the Darlings with It's Unbelievable How You Control My Love, released September 1968 on Stax Records, celebrating its 50th anniversary in 2007. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large, and a few items that have come to our attention during the day today. The Arts Center of the Ozarks says tonight's auditions for their upcoming production of No Sex, Please, We're British have been scrapped. Auditions will now be tomorrow and Wednesday night at 7 p.m. at the ACO in Springdale. Sparks Health System and Summit Medical Center announced this morning the appointment of a new CEO. Charles Stewart will have the job as of September 30th. He comes to Sparks after 2 years as CEO for Health Management Hospitals in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. The University of Arkansas Athletic Department announced the men's basketball non-conference schedule today via Twitter. The first game will take place Friday, November 15th at home against Southern Illinois University Edwardsville. Other games announced this morning include a home game against Louisiana Lafayette. That'll be in Bud Walton on November 15th. And SMU will be in Fayetteville on November 18th. The Fort Smith Public Library will present a class for teen graphic novel writing. It's going to be held at the Miller Branch Library beginning a week from today, September 16th. If you'd like more about this event, which is free, you can call 783-0229. You can also go to the website, fortsmithlibrary.org. And this reminder, the 6th Annual Fiber Art Show and Fair will take place Saturday, October 12th from 10 until 4 at Ozark Folkways in Winslow. The event will feature a diverse display of fiber arts, demonstrations, homemade food. There will also be live music all day. Artists interested in participating in the show should go to the website ozarkfolkways.org to download an entry form. You can also call Ozark Folkways to have an entry form mailed to you. Their phone number, 634-3791.
Barrett Baber will host a release party for his latest album, Battlefield Us, Saturday night, but you can listen to the entire album now at KUAF.com/mixdown.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Theater Squared Season 8 continues with performances of The Spiritualist, a world premiere by Robert Ford, through September 15th at Walton Art Center's Nadine Baum Studios. Inspired by a true story, this comic drama follows a widow's unlikely rise to fame after channeling the spirits of dead composers and completing their unfinished symphonies. Tickets and more information available at theater2.org or 443-5600. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Goshen. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for spending part of your Monday with Ozarks at Large. Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio for a brand new edition of our daily program. That's tomorrow at noon. Thanks so much for listening. Have a good Monday.